being involved in frontline defense of both individuals and organizations who have been politically targeted in both of these contexts. And also, you have done some individual support work, legal support work for people who have been directly charged under such legislation. So I understand there's kind of two streams there. But what I think is really interesting and important to underline is that sort of policy connection and political connection between these two moments, which I feel is not underlined enough in a lot of the sort of analysis that we're seeing about the present. So, Shane, if you could maybe just introduce yourself and share any thoughts about that. Thank you so much.
So, yeah, you had asked about kind of basically the through lines between sort of the present moment and the post 9/11 moment. And I think, you know, really a certain kind of, you know, xenophobia seems a little maybe too broad, really an anti-immigrant bias or focus is really maybe the most important. And I think, you know, it's very easy to see now where Trump is demonizing, you know, all sorts of, you know, immigrants as kind of presumptively criminal and going after breaking up families, you know, even though he promised to remove criminals, going after breaking up families by removing people who just happen to be out of documentation, sometimes people who've been here since they were small children, not caring whether it breaks up families. It's just a policy of cruelty directed at the alien other, right? And it's a little bit hard for people sometimes to think about the kind of post 9/11 policies, which on their face were justified as kind of counterterrorism measures, right? You know, in reality, almost everything that we did after 9/11 was carefully directed in its kind of legal severity at non-citizens. And that's one reason why it was allowed to proceed, right? The U.S. and Canada also are kind of unique among developed nations in that, you know, 10% of the population in the United States is non-citizens. You know, until the huge refugee crises in Syria, Iraq, and so forth, I feel like you couldn't get anywhere close to those numbers with developed European countries, right? You don't come anywhere close to that in England, where there is a big immigrant population from the colonies, but you're primarily, you know, talking about second and third generation British-born British citizens, right, who happened to, three generations ago, have come over from, you know, Pakistani Kashmir or something like that, right? So in the U.S., we could do, you know, very drastic things like the Guantanamo detentions or the special interest detentions or all sorts of reporting requirements, you name it, you know, the use of material witness warrants, right, typically directed at non-citizens, right, could do all sorts of oppressive things and justify them to the population with a wink by, you know, noting that they were directed only at non-citizens. And so, you know, while, you know, some people were being asked to trade off a huge amount of liberty in exchange for a little bit of security for you, you were only getting the benefit, you as a U.S. citizen were getting the benefit of the security boost without giving up any liberty, because the people giving up the liberty were the alien other, who happened to be 10% of the people living among us, right? And so, you know, you see this from the beginning. Like I mentioned, the special interest detentions, right? And it's very clear that, you know, anybody who was brought in out of status after 9/11, who with no immigration documentation, you know, who was, you know, from a short list of Arab or South Asian countries and was male, was labeled as of special interest to the terrorism investigation as long as they were Muslim, right? And so the Muslim part got all the attention, right? And the out of status. But, you know, really that's a national origin-based, you know, program of immigration discrimination, right? You know, same way with Guantanamo, where, you know, one of the fundamental realities of it is not that, you know, people were picked up on the battlefield because they largely weren't, not that we had reason to suspect people of connections to terrorism because after a few years we learned that most of them were swept in. It was that they're all Muslim males, right? Every single last one of them. And even on bigger picture things, like, you know, there was a huge internal reorganization of the American bureaucracy to create kind of a Department of Interior Security. I don't know what the equivalent might be in Canada or the UK, but here the Department of Homeland Security was a new post 9/11 creation. And, you know, the most significant thing about it was removing immigration controls and border controls from the Justice Department, where it had sat because the Justice Department has to adjudicate immigration claims of people, you know, who may look like they're deportable, but they have an asylum claim or they qualify under one of the many amnesties that had been issued over the years for people whose documentation wasn't in order, but who had lived here for a long time, might have been married, might have had children, right? There were all these things to be adjudicated. So immigration had sat in the Justice Department. You know, a generation before, it had sat in the Commerce Department in the 1930s. Before that, it had sat in the Treasury because it was considered to be part of labor, which was not yet its own department, right? So we moved from Treasury to Commerce to Justice. And then after 9/11, we created a terrorism department and put immigration in there, and immigration and border control is the bulk of what DHS does now, right? What does that have to do with a terrorist attack carried out by 19 people who were here legally, by and large, right? I mean, you can argue about whether they were fulfilling the terms of their student visas properly, but that's pretty technical. You had basically a bunch of people with a lot of money who used the money to buy their way in, right? And who were from countries like Saudi Arabia, where it was pretty, you know, permissive to enter because the country is rich, right? So, you know, again, one of the major bureaucratic responses was to create this unified department, but the unified department was really a department of xenophobia, right? You know, and moving it out of Justice, you know, is, you know, had a symbolic value as well as maybe a technical one, right? That we are eventually going to change the laws to make it harder and harder for people to have kind of legal sorts of claims to be adjudicated in front of immigration judges, you know, who were, you know, Department of Justice officials, right? So over and over again, you see, you know, this kind of focus on immigrants, this kind of, you know, traditional reflexive xenophobia reflected in things that happened after 9/11 that were kind of sold to us as being about security. But really weren't, you know? I mean, you know, it sort of corresponds to the idea that a huge amount of what we did after 9/11 was not scientifically calculated to make us safer. It was designed to look tough, and the group against whom we were being tough were foreigners, right? You know, so, I mean, look, Guantanamo, they threw a curtain of secrecy around the whole place for 2 years, wouldn't even tell people who was there until 2005, you know, didn't give people any right of access to kind of a third party or a judge to argue that they were wrongly detained. And they filled the place up with people they swept off, you know, the streets in Afghanistan and mostly in Pakistan. That's where most of the people detained came from. You know, they detained anybody who was Arab, basically, in Pakistan or Afghanistan. They were visually distinct. They put bounties on people's heads, swept in a whole ton of people, and claimed that these people held in secret detention were 600 suspected terrorists. And nobody knew any better because, you know, they didn't know that these were people brought in based on profiling criteria in sweeps. They thought we actually had evidence, right? And the fact that they threw secrecy over the whole thing and didn't give anyone any judicial process, let them get away with that lie. Let them, you know, basically defer some of the or deflect some of the pressure for allowing 9/11 to happen, right? But, you know, what you had at base there was really, you know, kind of a, you know, a xenophobic policy of harshness, of legal procedural harshness and detention conditions harshness directed at aliens, right? And all the other policies kind of fall into that category too. Their harshness was sold to the American public as being somehow a means of kind of more efficient counterterrorism. But what it really was kind of a performative cruelty directed at foreigners, right?
Right now, we're seeing a lot of discourse where there's an attempt to exceptionalize the actions being taken by the Trump administration. And of course, there's legal particularities, but I think it's important to maybe hear your expertise of understanding sort of the infrastructure and sort of both politically, but also like on a legal basis between the policies that you're describing post 9/11 and the present. Of course, special registration policies after 9/11 are different than temporary bans on migration. But I do think there's a political connection, but I would also imagine there's important administrative connections.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, you know, one of the first things is just in terms of like shutting down immigration from certain lists of countries that, you know, tend to be Muslim countries or, you know, perhaps shithole countries as Trump would characterize them. You know, it appears that this kind of thing is, you know, in violation of Congress's fundamental legislative control over the immigration process, but it's framed in terms of emergency powers. And so that's kind of a, you know, a consistent thing that we see, right? The Congress over the years has deferred or delegated to the executive the ability to identify emergencies take certain measures, akin to wartime embargoes in response to it, right? So Trump's signature policy, these tariffs, right, which are, you know, have a huge impact in every respect all over the world, they are created under essentially a modernized version of the wartime embargo powers that go back to World War I, the Trading with the Enemy Act, right, that was updated in something called IEEPA, the International Economic Emergency Powers Act. And it seems like Trump is abusing this, but the courts have let him get away with it, you know, in part because the kind of conventional understanding has been whenever there's a real emergency, the president's got to be empowered to act. You know, Congress usually sets trade policy and signs treaties, you know, ratifies treaties about trade policy and has a huge say in, you know, hugely economically significant things like tariffs on foreign nations. But here the president is just grabbing that authority based on, you know, the presumption that Congress has delegated him actually kind of fulsome powers. Same kind of thing on the immigration front. You know, Congress typically has had the controlling hand in setting immigration policy, right? In setting quotas to different countries, you know, and all that kind of thing. You know, again, Trump has, you know, under the kind of, you know, bogus claim that there's an emergency situation, has decided to bypass all that and, you know, engage in this kind of these kind of performative sort of limits directed at basically Muslim countries, right? With a few others thrown in there as window dressing to keep the courts from, you know, finding that it was discriminatory. So, you know, was there a little bit of that post 9/11? Sure. I mean, you know, the Patriot Act was passed with, you know, very kind of foreshortened consideration by Congress in a matter of weeks after 9/11. Civil libertarians complained that even though there was only one vote against it in the House of Representatives out of 435 reps, that it went too far. And yet they went farther than anything that Congress authorized in the Patriot Act, and they never really used any of its provisions, right? It provided for certain forms of immigration detention without redress to kind of judicial relief. They went much farther than that. You know, they pulled in all these special interest detainees and kept their detentions essentially kind of secret from the outside world for months. Well, they did whatever they wanted with them. And then Guantanamo, that's just a next level kind of thing, right? They held even, you know, a handful of, you know, I guess one U.S. citizen at Guantanamo initially, you know, based on an assertion of just, you know, fundamental executive emergency powers, and only later decided to bring him to the U.S. But then, you know, again said he's still an enemy combatant, even though Yasser Hamdi's held here in South Carolina. We don't have to give him the judicial process that he would ordinarily have if we held him, you know, pursuant to the ordinary criminal power, which is usually the only way that the executive can hold someone in his circumstance, right? So again, you know, assertions of kind of fundamental presidential emergency powers that kind of trump, in many cases, Congress, you know, affirmatively saying you cannot do this, right? There was a 1960s statute, I forget what it was called. It's 18 U.S.C. 4001A that is designed to ensure that the president can't detain citizens, you know, based on these kind of emergency assertions. And it seemed to plainly apply to this former Guantanamo detainee, Yasser Hamdi, who they claimed they figured out was a U.S. citizen at some point during the litigation and brought him to the U.S. as a result. It appeared that Congress had said, you know, clearly cannot do this, executive branch. And yet the Supreme Court basically gave a nod and a wink to what the president was doing. And of course, once, you know, the validity of those emergency powers was recognized at the Supreme Court, they quickly came to an agreement to release this guy to Saudi Arabia, where he still lives today, right? You know, so again, performative, not substantive, which I think the fact of his quick release after the Supreme Court ratified the emergency powers is a sign that there wasn't really an emergency there, you know. I mean, my favorite example is a local New York City case that nobody's ever heard of. After 9/11, the Trade Center collapses, and a lot of the kind of wiring infrastructure of Manhattan, the telecommunications, the electricity, gets really heavily damaged by the collapse of these gigantic buildings and four or five others surrounding the two towers, right? And so Con Edison, the electric company, is constantly working 24/7 on an emergency basis for months to restore the electricity to lower Manhattan. And there happens to be a sick electrical worker for Con Ed who's wearing his turban and pops out of a manhole cover at like 9:30 p.m., what in ordinary times would be a suspiciously late time to be working on power cables, pops out of a manhole cover under the street. Three different people call it in to 911, the emergency police number, and there's a whole hoo-ha about it, right? And it ends up being a big police response and disruption before they realize what has happened. And I guess, because of this sort of, turban-wearing person panic, the New York City Subway Authority, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, MTA, decides to create a policy that sick subway workers cannot wear their turbans at work. They have to issue an MTA-issued uniform hat. The problem is there is no MTA-issued uniform hat. And some of the MTA hats that you can buy through the uniform store don't have an MTA logo on them. So this became a lawsuit that we worked on and eventually won, and you were allowed to wear a transit uniform colored like navy blue, dust star or turban while driving the train. But again, completely performative. This was a show made to reassure white people that, there weren't turban wearing, in this case, Punjabi Indian, ethnic origin folks driving your train, right? Which, maybe to somebody who didn't know any better and, quote unquote, ordinary American would perceive this as looking like Osama bin Laden, right? So again, a lot of what was done on kind of a, snap of the fingers, not very well thought out emergency basis was performative. And while, it was way too harsh to have passed muster in ordinary times, the fact that it was directed at people who were perceived to be an alien other made it politically palatable to do this kind of thing, right? You ordinarily, if it were Irish Americans who were being subject to some new uniform requirement, that would produce a backlash, right? To do it against, a micro minority in the U.S. of sick Americans. There are far fewer Punjabi turban-wearing Indian origin folks here than there are, say, in Toronto. To do it against a micro minority in the U.S. Doesn't come with a political cost, and it comes with a huge political benefit of, being security theater, letting people feel like you are going after the people who deserve the scrutiny really hard, even though once you unpack it in some detail, it's clearly nonsense as a policy.
Thank you so much for the conversation today.
Great. Thanks for having me again, Stefan.
That was a conversation with Shane Katadil of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. Clearly a very critically important organization. I would encourage people to look them up and learn more about their work, Center for Constitutional Rights. Thanks so much to Shane for taking the time to be on Free City Radio. This has been another edition. I'm Stefan Christoph. I host and produce the program, and we broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11, on CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 AM, on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Look us up as a podcast. Just search Free City Radio through your preferred podcast platform. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.
is Bird Nook. Descriptive names can be a great help when you're getting to know a new bird, like the five-striped sparrow. Like many sparrows, this little bird is mostly dark gray and brown. But the five white stripes radiating from the center of his face, and that distinctive song, are unmistakable. Similarly, the band-tailed pigeon gets their moniker from the band of light gray feathers at the tip of their tail that these stocky birds display in flight. Or the barred owl. That name isn't because these owls are excellent storytellers or jailbirds either. It actually refers to their striped backs and streaked chests, like alternating bars of colors running across their bodies. The streak-backed oriole and lineated woodpecker have similarly patterned plumage. They'd be joined by the flammulated owl, a tiny raptor with streaky feathers and a flash of orange, whose name evokes the ephemeral shapes of a flickering flame. Whether a bird be flammulated, lineated, banded, or barred, you can learn more about them at birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Remmel. BirdNote is grateful to the many contributions of Dr. Gordon Oriens and for his ongoing support of the show.
We love us some BirdNote.